Chapter 31 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 31. Since I finished my last chapter, I have consulted my wife, and she agrees that I should print extracts from some of her letters written at this time. In an ordinary way, such letters would be considered quite private and sacred, but there is nothing ordinary about our history, and to ignore that fact is only to court trouble and to pave the way to future misunderstanding. Both my wife and I are poets. I have always been very jealous and particular about the use of the words poet and poetry. However much I may like a man or a woman, and however much I may desire to please him or her, I will not say that he or she has written good poetry, a very rare thing, especially in this age, unless I really think it. When I say that my wife is a poet, I mean it, and I consider that she has written better poetry than any other woman of my time, not excepting Mrs. Meynell, for whose work I have the greatest admiration. To say, as I dare say will be said, that I call her a good poet just because she is my wife, would be putting the cart before the horse. It was just the fact that she had written such really beautiful stuff that, combined with her exceptional beauty and grace, drew me to her and differentiated her from all the other girls I had ever met. As I am at least as good a judge of what is and is not fine poetry as any man now living, I have a perfect right and qualification to estimate the value of her work. This being the case, and granting therefore that my wife and I are both considerable poets, and seeing that I have been very much against my will and inclination, forced for years into a fierce glare of publicity, it is merely foolish to ignore the certainty that after we are dead, everything we have done, said, or written will be the object of public interest. The few remaining letters written by Oscar Wilde to me which I did not destroy, including some of those he wrote to me at Berneval directly after he came out of prison, were sold by me, directly after the ransom case, to the late Mr. Bernard Quaritch, who was at that time lying ill in bed. I sold them because I was, for the time being, ruined and penniless, and because it was absolutely necessary for me to raise money, chiefly in order to be able to fight the Chancery case against Colonel Custance for the custody of my son, then a boy of 11 years. Mr. Quaritch was too ill to see me when I offered him the letters, about 35 of them. He offered me, and I accepted, as far as I remember, £350. At the time I sold the letters, and also, for £200 or £300, all the autographed copies of his own books which Oscar Wilde had given me, I hated the very name of Wilde. My idea was to dissociate myself as far as I could forever afterwards from him and from any memory of him. I remember thinking at the time when I sold the books and letters that this was the only good turn Wilde had ever done me. I understood when I sold the letters, through a member of his firm, to Mr. Quaritch, that Mr. Quaritch pledged himself not to sell the letters during his own and my lifetime. This stipulation, which I claim to have been made, and indeed voluntarily made by Mr. Quaritch himself, is denied by those who at present control the firm. So, as it is merely a case of my word against theirs, I will say no more about it. But it is a fact that Messrs. Quaritch sold the letters very shortly afterwards, after the death of Mr. Bernard Quaritch, and that they subsequently changed hands several times. In the end, they were bought in New York by Mr. William Andrews Clark, to whose privately printed edition of the letters I have already referred, for the large sum of £2,000. My own letters to Wilde, most of which are, I suppose, in the possessions of the heirs or executors of the late Robert Ross, who stole them, will be just as valuable when I am dead. The same applies to my letters to my wife, and hers to me, many of which will also, sooner or later, almost inevitably be given to the world. So that if I publish extracts from a few of them now, I am only anticipating what is bound to happen. Here is one of Olive's letters, written before I went to America. Dear sweet prince, I am thinking of you every moment and praying that your luck may turn and that things may be better soon. The little princess is most unhappy about the dear beautiful prince. She cried when his letter came and wished, oh, how she wished, to be rich and powerful, that she might help him in some way. I was too sad to dream yesterday, so I took up my imaginary portraits and read about Denis le Auxerrois, because he reminds me of you, a flaxen and flowery creature. And then I read Shakespeare's sonnets, and wondered why people should have worried so much who they were written to, because, you see, I know it was you. Shakespeare must have met you in another world. When in the chronicles of wasted time I see descriptions of the fairest whites, I see their antique pen would have expressed even such beauty as you master now, so all their praises are but prophecies of this our time, all you prefiguring. Let me see you on the 30th, if only for a moment. Opal. Olive was called Opal by her friends, although I always preferred to call her Olive, partly because her first volume of poems was called Opals, and partly because she suggested that beautiful stone. She always wore opals at that time. The rows of dots in her letters are characteristic, as she seldom used commas and full stops. None of her letters at this time are dated, which makes it difficult to fix the order in which they arrived, but the next was almost certainly written just after we first met. Weston Hall, Norwich. Beautiful Prince, I must send a few words to you by the early post, just to thank you for your sweetness to me. It was so lovely to look into your clear, brave eyes and talk to you, and hear your voice and your laugh. It was so lovely that I can hardly believe it was not all a dream. When shall I get another letter from you? And tell me, are you pleased with your little princess? No, I am not your princess. She will be very beautiful. But meanwhile, love me a little, please, kind and beautiful prince. Opal. The letter that follows was evidently written just as I was starting for New York. Weston Hall, Norwich. My own boy, what a joy to get that last little letter from you. But now at last I feel you have really gone, and I'm miserable without you. Last night I dreamed of you and woke to find my pillow wet with tears, and I stretched out my empty arms to you and called you, my prince, very softly, but you were too far away to hear. Oh, how I miss you, your sweet golden head, your small red mouth, always, it seems, a little shy of my kisses, and above all your great blue eyes, the most beautiful eyes a boy ever had, like two blue flowers under water, as I told you once, and those carved lids fringed with lashes thick and long. I think I wrote that poem to you. How my lips love them, if only I might kiss them tonight. But if I were to write forever, I should not be able to tell you how much I love you. Here a page and a half are omitted. I will send you the photographs as soon as they are ready, and I will also send you to New York a little cigarette case for your birthday on the 22nd, isn't it? I seem to be scribbling dreadfully, but I forget even to write well when I write to you. I forget everything except that I love you. See, what a child I am! But you will understand because you are a child too, my darling. My own Bosie, whom God made for me, I think. Good night, my poet. And you must write a poem to me, I think. I dream beautiful dreams tonight, and I will pray that they all come true. Your loving Olive. The basilisk sends his love to you, and the young boy basilisk, if he is not lost. The little heart is safe. The young boy basilisk was a ring with an emerald snake's head and ruby eyes which Olive gave me, but who the other basilisk was I cannot now remember. Here is another letter, evidently written after I got back from New York. 19 Dover Street, W. Darling Prince, when are you coming to London? I am so longing to see you. I have taken 2 stalls for the importance of being earnest for next Saturday afternoon. Could you come? It would be a way of meeting. I shall say I am going with George, so that will be all right. My beautiful, London is very dark without you. Come out of the clouds, my sunbeam. Your page. This last letter was evidently written to me when I was staying at Clouds, the place in Wiltshire of my great-uncle, Percy Wyndham. I give 2 more letters, the first written before I went to New York, and the second after I came back. Weston Hall, Norwich. My own Prince, the little heart is sweet. This was a locket I sent her with a lock of my hair. And I shall always, always wear it, even when you have forgotten me and married the beautiful, rich princess who will give you all those lovely things you ought to have. I miss you more than I can say, for I love you beyond everything in the world, and I think we shall never be happy together again. Write to me soon, soon, and tell me you love your little page, and that one day you will come back to him. My prince, my prince. I found Mummy rather unhappy as Tanny, her governess, had told her we met that time in London. Wasn't it horrible of her? However, Mummy has forgiven us, and all will be well if she doesn't find out about Paris. She would never forgive any of us then, I am afraid. Goodbye, my darling. May all your dreams come true. I cannot write more. Goodbye. Olive. The next one appears not to be signed, and breaks off abruptly, but probably a sheet is missing. My own boy prince, send me the photograph at once, please. It will be something to look at till I see you, my darling, my beautiful. I have another photograph for you, better than the last, and I am having it tinted for you. Don't stay too long away from London, as I shall certainly be up on the 30th, and write to me to 19 Dover Street, Piccadilly, W. As your friend's writing is so utterly unlike yours, they would never guess anything. Tell him not to forget to put Miss Olive Custance, as then they cannot give them to Mummy by mistake. A dreadful thing happened to your last wire. It was opened by Daddy. However, Bosie conveyed nothing to him, so I said it was from Natalie, and soon after sent myself a wire from her to say she was going to Italy, as Mummy does not like her. I think you will laugh at all this. But, oh, why does fate make it so difficult for us to meet? I have no doubt that some of my critics will say that I ought not to have chosen letters which make flattering reference to my personal appearance. My answer is twofold. In the first place, I cannot choose letters which are free from such a reference, for the simple reason that they do not exist. Every letter Olive wrote me at this time, and, for that matter, for a good many years afterwards, contained such references. My second answer is that this admiration of the girl for the boy is in itself beautiful and brave and right and classic, even if it does not commend itself to modern stupidity. Shakespeare's heroines, who were the model of everything that is perfect in womanhood, did not hesitate to express similar sentiments. "Swear by thy gracious self who art the god of my idolatry," says Juliet to Romeo, and, also referring to him, "O serpent heart hid with a flowering face," and she retracts the serpent heart part of it immediately afterwards, and accuses herself bitterly for it. I could give 100 more instances. Indeed, so far from being the least ashamed of the fact that a lovely girl thought me a beautiful boy prince, and said and wrote it on every possible occasion, I glory in it. These letters are, moreover, a crushing answer to Frank Harris, who, not content with attacking my character with foul lies and misrepresentations, goes out of his way in his ugly book to make half-hearted but spiteful attempts to run down my personal appearance as it was when I first met Oscar Wilde. This is all part of the modern Bolshevik hatred of beauty in any form, which is typical of much of the tendency of modern art and literature. I will never be a party to it, nor to the idiotic convention which makes so many, who really think it, afraid to say that a boy may be, and frequently is, just as beautiful as a girl. As a model of what may and may not properly be said or written on any subject, Shakespeare will always be good enough for me. End of chapter 31.